Well, who do we turn to for help, especially financial help? In a moment, James Parrish back with us. He'll tell you who on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. Well, that was a scary couple hours, wasn't it? James Parrish, author of 24-plus books, editor-in-chief of ChristianMoney.com. He regularly appears as a financial commentator on a number of radio and television shows nationwide. By the age of 30, he was a multimillionaire. By the age of 40, he was broke. What the heck happened? Here's James Parrish back on Coast to Coast. Boy, what a roller coaster you have been on, James.
Yes, sir, it sure has been. Great to be with you tonight. I've got a pot of coffee on my wife, and the dogs are asleep, so it's just you and me, pal.
You got it, all the way. Wait, tell me what happened, exactly what happened. How'd you make that money? How'd you lose it?
Well, in my early 20s, I became a stockbroker and was very, very successful at it. Ended up opening my own brokerage firm, which went nationwide. And there I was at the age of 30, worth millions of dollars, published author, traveling around the world. And I did what a lot of people do. I sort of lost control of the day-to-day management of my money. And my brother was my accountant. And I figured, well, I can trust my brother. He's family. And let him take over literally, you know, the ongoing management of my own money and our business's money. And my accountant came in and explained to me that there was over $100,000 missing during one of our meetings. And one thing led to the next, George, and we uncovered over $2 million of embezzlement, which represented, you know, literally all of our operating capital was gone. And it was my own brother. And if you can imagine not only losing all of your money, I mean, literally going from one day to the next, and then it's your own brother.
A double whammy.
What a moment.
Oh, my gosh. My gosh. What happened? Did you end up prosecuting him, or how'd you handle that?
Well, oddly enough, most people don't know about this, but embezzlement is a rarely prosecuted crime. And in this case, I went all the way up to the FBI, and no one would prosecute him. This was, of course, after 9/11, and so they told me they had bigger fish to fry at the FBI, and the local police said that this case is really too big and complicated for them to get involved with. So there I was, left with no criminal prosecution, but I did sue my brother civilly, and I got a judgment for $4.7 million, which I never collected because I ended up in bankruptcy, and then the bankruptcy takes that judgment as an asset of the bankruptcy, and so I never saw a dollar from it, but it was a moral victory to be able to prove that you know, he did embezzle the money and sort of clear my name in that sense.
Oh my gosh. And you obviously you've recovered somewhat.
I'm in great shape today, and you know, my life is it has never been better than it is today. I just finished my second degree black belt. I have a sailboat that my wife and I spend a lot of time on. I am a lead trumpet in a professional big band.
Boy, cool.
I'm doing all these great, wonderful things, living my dream. And, you know, as much as I thought I was happy before and that I had it all when I had all the money, I really have a much better life today. And the book just outlines all of the miracles that brought me to where I'm at. I mean, literally sitting in a beautiful home that we were able to pay cash for. Having a sailboat, which was a lifelong dream to have a boat and have the time to enjoy it, to go back to my passion of music. You know, people have asked me, do you think that God caused you to lose everything so you could have this happen? I don't think that's what happened. I believe that God allowed me to, working through the process, to actually turn this into a good situation. Even though it may not have meant to be, it has given me an opportunity to reinvent my life, and I haven't been happier.
Do you think, Jim, that everybody needs to hit rock bottom in order to change and grow?
You know, I don't think you have to hit rock bottom, but unfortunately, I don't think most of us are willing to listen to God until we do hit rock bottom. And that's sort of one of the lessons that I learned in all of this is, you know, I was always a spiritual person. I was always a person that believed in prayer, but I didn't really have, I believe, a complete understanding of what prayer is. I would pray you know, as a spiritual person, but it was more like a one-way conversation, George, where I would talk to God, but I wouldn't wait to hear what he had to say back. And when you get to the point that you're planning out your own suicide, when you're throwing up blood, which is where I was at, you're ready to listen. And that hopefully will never, you know, I'll never have to reach that point again before I remember that lesson, that prayer is a two-way conversation.
The spirituality, did you have it when you were younger?
Yeah, I did. I was raised in the church, and you know, I always had a belief that there was a God, and that he was my savior and he was part of my life. But I sort of, to be honest with you, in my 20s, I was doing so well that I honestly did not need God. I mean, that as much as I look back and know that at the time, I didn't really process it in that way. I know that that's what was happening now that I look back in retrospect, that I really was doing so well financially, I didn't have a reason to have God in my life. And so I probably had a very, very minimal spiritual life during those years. And that's what led to my downfall, I believe.
I was going to say, maybe had you had that kind of spiritual outlook, it might not have happened to you this way.
You know, it's hard to know. And when you look back in life, when you look at the tragedies, of course, at the moment, you just wish you were in a different place and it wasn't happening to you. But when you look back and you see how these tragedies were able to make you a better person, and give you opportunities to change your life, you can really realize and see the blessing that was there at the time. You know, if I hadn't lost all the money, I'd probably have a lot more money than I have today, but I don't think I would be any happier. In fact, I might have died already of a heart attack.
Yeah.
That's the kind of pace that I was keeping up. And so it was an opportunity for me, like I said, to reinvent myself, to go back to many of my core passions like the martial arts and music and sailing, and to be able to spend time with my wife and my children and find a new path, a better path, a more healthy path with my life.
Let's get into some of the various aspects, James, that people have been going through over the last 6 years, let's say since 2008, when we started hitting the bump in the road. It's not easy for a lot of people out there, is it?
Well, I'll tell you what, there's nothing like losing your home to foreclosure, and we lost our home to foreclosure. And I remember probably the lowest point in my life was when, at that time, my youngest daughter was 5 years old, and she came walking into my office at the house, and she looked up at me and she said, "Daddy, Mommy and I have been praying, are we going to be able to keep our house?" This is a 5-year old. And I closed the door after she left, and I cried and wept harder than I had ever wept in my life, wondering what was happening to me. And here's a 5-year old kid asking her dad, "Are we going to be able to keep the house?" And you know, with all the foreclosures that we've been through, George, there's nothing so horrible for a family than to lose their home. You know, the family, you know, there's neighbors there. It's like you're losing, the kids lose the school they're going to. All of their friends are in the neighborhood. You've built these relationships over the years. And as a man especially, you know, looking at yourself as the head of your home, that you're supposed to be the provider, that may be a sexist thing to say, I apologize. But, you know, to a man especially, you know, to lose the family home, and there's so many people that have gone through this. In fact, you know, if you just Google the phrase, you know, suicide killed family, there are so many men who have committed suicide and killed their family as well because they couldn't pay the bills. I mean, that's literally the point of desperation that they reached, that they thought my family would be better off dead than to be in the financial predicament that we're in currently. So the foreclosures, the bankruptcy, when I went through my own bankruptcy, George, I saw a man who was 90 years old walk up to the judge. And he was steadied on both sides by his two adult children, and he began to cry as he explained to the judge that due to medical bills, he had to file for bankruptcy so he didn't lose his mobile home. And this was a man that was losing more than money. He was losing his soul as he stood up there and cried, because, you know, there's a generation that just looks at bankruptcy in a different way than we do today, that it's literally like the greatest humiliation or failure you can have as a person. So many times these financial losses, George, really represent more than just a loss of money. people literally lose their soul, their heart, and their life in many cases.
They sure do. You know, I've been following this Malaysian Airlines disaster, and apparently the pilot had an affair, but his wife had said, hey, I'm done with you, and she was moving out, and he couldn't handle it. And I don't know if that contributed to this episode or not, but, you know, people that go through this kind of stress, James, whether it's financial or personal, a lot of them can't handle it, can they?
You know, the emotional pain that I was in, I had never experienced anything like this before. When I was in my 20s and early 30s, if I heard about someone that was considering suicide, I thought, well, they're crazy. That's just what a goofy, crazy person does. When you are in that much emotional pain, like I was and many people are, you're looking for any way to get out of that pain, whether it's alcohol or drugs or killing yourself. It is an unbearable pain. It is a pain that follows you into your sleep. You're sleeping, George. I'm asleep, but I have nightmares about not being able to pay my bills, so I can't even have a restful night's sleep.
Yeah.
And then to wake up, and within 30 seconds of waking up, realize what I'm facing again another day of my journey of being completely broke and wondering where the money is going to come from for groceries for that week. It was a hell of an existence.
What did you do, James, to change your life?
Well, I reached a point one day. This was after three separate episodes of planning out my suicide in detail. And I kid you not.
Oh, my God.
I reached a point one night where I was throwing up blood in the bathroom, and my wife came in. And
what was causing that? Just stress and nerves?
Just the stress from everything that was happening. And, you know, not only the loss of all the money, but the fact that it was my brother. And,
yeah.
And also, as you read the book, that I almost went to prison as a result of his embezzlement, because I had part owners that were silent partner investors in my business. And they thought that maybe I had strip mined my own company. And so I was facing like a potential criminal prosecution. So here I was, I'd lost everything, and I was facing a possible criminal prosecution. I was totally cleared of all of that, but just the fact that I had to, you know, face the possibility of that put me in that point, literally throwing up blood. And my wife said, this has got to end. I mean, whatever you've got to do, this has got to end. So I did go into counseling, but even more than the counseling that I did, where I went to see a counselor once a month, it was a moment sitting out on the beach praying, and praying with a totally different approach than I'd ever prayed before, which was I shut my mouth, and I said to God, I said, what's happening to me? Why is this happening to me? What do I need to do?
You're thinking.
And I sat there for two hours filling out pages and pages on a yellow tablet with what the Lord was telling me to do, and I had never, ever asked him to speak to me in that way before, and he did.
And what did he tell you?
Things that I would never think to do, which is why I know that it was coming from God. You know, specific ideas and strategies. For example, today, my life, I don't have a big building with lots of employees like I used to. I've completely reinvented myself. I make my living 100% over the internet. I write books and ebooks. I teach courses on internet business over the internet. These were all concepts and ideas revealed to me between 10 and 12 years ago in those prayer sessions, and that's where I derive all of my income from today.
And it works for you.
It absolutely works for me, and I'll tell you what, there is no greater peace in life than knowing what God wants you to do and doing it and then watching the results that follow. It's the most exciting journey that you'll ever go on.
When did you start realizing, James, that this is changing for me? It's turning around again. Thank God. When did that happen? How did it happen?
Well, I would tell you that it would probably make a better story if I said it happened overnight, but it didn't happen overnight. I went through, I would say, a minimum of 5 to 6 years of living hand to mouth, literally week to week.
But you never gave up.
Financial existence. And it was a journey, and my book outlines the journey, and I believe I would have been robbed of so many wonderful lessons that I learned if my journey was shorter. Now, at the time, I would have never told you that. I wanted it to end every morning when I woke up. I didn't want to face another day of going to bankruptcy court, losing my house to foreclosure, finding another place to live, having the vehicles repossessed. That was my life. I didn't want to live that life. But going through that journey of 5 to 6 years changed me as a person. And I can look back now and say, man, you know what? At the time, I would never have wanted to be in those moments. But now that I know the blessings that they represent, how it changed me and all the things that I learned, it was quite a journey and quite a lesson, quite a life lesson.
Let's go through some of the techniques. And after the break, I want to get into some miracles that have occurred for you and have you outline that. And then we'll take calls next hour with people who might want to share some of their own stories. But you've come up with what you call an 11-step process, and we don't have to go through every one of them, but basically, how did you conceive of that? These were just things that happened to you?
Right. Well, over time in these prayer sessions where I would leave my cell phone, this was back in the day when you still had a beeper or a pager, leave all that stuff behind and take a yellow pad and go down to the beach and simply, I would start all of my prayer sessions by being thankful and grateful for what I had. And I found that that was so empowering and really changed my attitude. I mean, I still had my health. My wife had her health. My kids were all healthy. I mean, we had so many great things happening in our lives outside of money that because of the financial problems, I didn't notice any of those things. So I thought, you know, making a list of all the things that I can be thankful for was a tremendous way to begin praying. I also spent a lot of time in those prayer sessions just sitting, listening. You know, prayer, many times we view prayer as an action that we should be doing something or saying something. And I believe that the most effective prayer is sitting quietly and listening and waiting for God to speak to you and setting aside enough time for that to be able to happen. So in the book, I do have the 11 steps: being thankful, being grateful, asking for forgiveness for maybe the part of the problem that you personally could be responsible for, asking God to reveal to you specific steps to take and strategies to take, taking the time to listen and write those things down. And I mentioned this in the book, don't question the things that are coming to mind. You might say, well, that's a crazy idea. That must not be coming from God. Write it down. You can always pray over that again and refine those thoughts later. But some of those prayer sessions to this day, those are the things providing me with my full-time income. One other point here, don't limit God. You know, he might want you to move to another city. You know, so many times people say, well, there's not a job where I live.
Sure.
Well, maybe you should move. Consider a different line of work. Consider things that you would never consider before, maybe going back to school. A guy I know, he'd never gone to college. He went back to college. He went for 18 months, became a respiratory therapist. He said, Jim, as he laughed, he said, Jim, I walk around the hospital with a stethoscope on. Most of the people think I'm a doctor. And he laughed and he said, I make more than most of the doctors. And I only went to college for 18 months. He went back to school at almost the age of 40.
And he's happy
to become a respiratory therapist. And he's happy and he's thrilled and did that in less than 2 years of college.
Isn't that amazing? It really is.
Yeah. No, and that's in today's world. You can go back to school and really come out with a whole new career in a year or two.
Well, hold on, James. We're going to come right back in a moment. James Parrish with us, his work, How to Pray for a Financial Miracle. Next hour, we'll take your phone calls with James Parrish. Perhaps you can share one of your stories on how you went through a financial miracle as well. Back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back with James Parrish. James, what if people don't hear that special voice in their head? What if they're kind of left out there to do this all on their own?
Yeah, I get this question a lot. You know, Jim, you hear from God, but I don't.
Yeah.
I sit there and I pray and I don't hear anything. That will happen sometimes. It will happen sometimes. And my answer to that is wait. It will happen. Eventually, you will begin to recognize the voice of God. It's not an audible voice. It isn't for me. But I know the voice of God. And if you listen long enough, you will hear it. And that's the best advice I can give people. I know that's a little bit of a frustrating answer, but every person I've said that to has eventually come back to me and said, you're right. it took time, and I wanted a quicker turnaround. I wanted to do a one-minute prayer. That's why in the book we talk about a minimum of 2 hours for these prayer sessions, which you might only be able to do that once or twice a week because of your schedule. But I think that's an effective way to go, is to literally wait on God and wait to hear his voice.
Well, how much of this is truly reaching down within yourself and just pulling that out of somebody and saying, you know what, I can do this. I can change my life. I can move forward.
Well, George, today we don't think about how to solve our problems. When people have a problem, what's the first thing they do? They call technical support, or they call out to a friend, and they want to tell everybody what the problem is. We don't sit down and just think about our problems. You know, there was a time when cognitive reflection and thought was a really, important part of people's lives. And that's just not the case anymore. I mean, back in the farming days, how much time did people have to think, behind a plow when you're doing that kind of work all day? But today we're busy. We've got all kinds of devices beeping all around us, and the internet and all these things happening. You can, and I say this in the book, many times, even without prayer, many times, even without God, you can solve many of these problems just by sitting down and thinking through what could possibly be some answers here. But then when you add God to the equation, now you're really turbocharging it when you're in these episodes of meditation where you're sitting there not only putting your best thought process to work, but also asking God to add to that.
Let's go through some of these miracle stories. They fascinate me. And I'll just mention them quickly, then you can elaborate on them, James. You and your son, you were attending a jazz festival. What happened?
Yeah, there's a chapter in the book called Miracle at a Jazz Festival. And a lot of people, when they look at the book and they see that chapter, they think, now that's weird. How could there be a chapter on this in a book on prayer? But when you hear the story, it will absolutely blow your mind. Here in Palm Coast, Florida, and this was a few years back, right in the middle of my crisis when I had no money. Literally no money. My son was a young teenager, and he is a trumpet player, and I'm a trumpet player. So it was one of the things that we really, shared as a passion together, was our interest in jazz music. And there was a local jazz festival, George, and both he and I wanted to see the famed trumpet player Eddie Henderson. And it was a little bit confusing because this jazz festival had some venues that were free and then others that you had to pay to go into. We wrongly assumed that the Eddie Henderson concert would be open to the public and free without a ticket. So we went to this shopping village with a big stage in the middle of it, and it also has a small hotel. We were assuming that the Eddie Henderson concert would be on that stage. So my son and I, we got there 2 hours early, and here he is, a young kid, his eyes
all
excited,
like
saucers,
right?
Waiting to see Eddie Henderson, and we find out that the concert is not on this stage, and that the concert is at another venue, and it would be over $120 for me to get the ticket.
So, you're like getting slapped on in every direction.
So I'm literally about to cry, and my son, he says to me, Dad, it's okay. I know we don't have the money. It's no problem. And, that was such a wonderful moment when my son said that to me, Dad, that's okay. And so tears starting to well up in my eyes when he says that to me. We turn around and start leaving this small shopping village that has a hotel in it and the stage, and we're walking out, and who do we bump into as we're walking out? Eddie Henderson.
No.
And he looks at me and he says, are you a trumpet player? Just out of the blue.
It's not that you're holding a trumpet, right?
No. I said, are you Eddie Henderson? And he said, are you a trumpet player? And I said, how did you know? He said, I can see the scar on your lip. We all have one, don't we?
What do they call that, by the way?
What's that?
What do they call that little scar up there?
I don't know, but I've developed that scar over my lifetime of playing the trumpet, holding up a piece of metal up against your mouth. So Eddie Henderson, he says to me, are you a trumpet player? And I said, yes, and my son is as well. And he's got his trumpet case and everything, and he's got his hat on, and he says, well, are you coming to see my concert? And I didn't know what to say. What do I say? I'm meeting this guy who's one of my musical heroes, and I don't have the money to go to his concert. So I said to him, Mr. Henderson, I don't know how to tell you this. I would love to go to your concert. I'm going through something right now, and I can't afford to buy the ticket for my son and I to go see your concert. he said to me, "You're coming as my guest." And the minute he said that, George, a big white limousine pulled up, and he looked at us and he said, "Well, what are you waiting for? Get in." He invites us into his limousine with his other band member musicians.
I love this stuff.
We're riding in the limousine from this small hotel to the other venue. We walk up with Eddie Henderson to the gate, and the ticket takers look at us and they say, "Where's your ticket?" And Eddie Henderson looks at them and he said, "These are my guests." And he brought us in with him into the venue, and the folks there thought we were some, you know, VIP friends of Eddie Henderson. And they said to us, "Pick out any seat you want in the auditorium, and even if we have to move someone, we will. You can have any seat that you want." So my son and I, we sit there, we watch this amazing concert for free, riding in the limousine from the one venue to the other. It was almost like I had won a contest or something.
Yeah.
You know, go see Eddie Henderson ride in his limousine. All of this is happening to me. So the concert is over, and I forget that my car is 3 miles away at the other venue because I rode over in the limousine. So Eddie Henderson, after the show's over, he's signing autographs, talking to all those people. He comes out into the audience and finds me, and he says, "I know that you need a ride back." And he brings me back in his limousine all the way back to the venue, talks to us on the way there and back, asking us about our trumpet playing, talking with us. And my son to this day will tell you that that is probably the most favorite day of his life.
That is
and
amazing.
I had no money. I had not a dollar to go into that concert. And I can tell you, George, that that was God. There's just no way. The way that that man looked at me, Eddie Henderson, and said, "Are you a trumpet player?" And within a minute, I'm riding in his limousine with him, and I have no money to go to this concert. Those are the kinds of stories in the book that will really give people an insight as to what I'm talking about when I say the phrase financial miracle, because that's certainly one of them.
That is a miracle. And what did you think of Eddie? Just like
a wonderful man.
A wonderful person.
Just a wonderful guy. And you know, he treated us like we were just, you know, on his same level. And I mentioned him in the book. I haven't heard from him since, but he's written about in the book. And so I'm sure someday he's going to probably put two and two together. Someone's going to tell him about the book, you know, where he's at up in New York, and say, "Hey, there's a guy that you took to your concert. He actually mentioned you in his book." You know, talk about a reversal of fortune, and then back again for me to be back in a position writing books, being on radio and TV, and doing well again. But he met me in the valley when I was at one of my lowest points and was a perfect gentleman and was an angel on that day for sure.
Now, did you ever stay in touch with him?
I did write him a letter, and I sent him a copy of the book. I'm assuming he got it. We haven't heard from him, but I'm assuming that he got it. I did write a letter also to
Juilliard,
like,
he's in his 70s.
Letting them know what he did for us.
I wonder if he knows how he changed your life just by being a nice person.
You know, I mean, that's all that it takes is one person like that. And to me, the $130 or wherever it was to get into that concert, that was like all the money in the world to me. I mean, if I could have gotten that money anyway legally for my son sitting there, you know, to take him to see this concert, I mean, anything I could have done, there's nowhere where I could get that money from. And here I am riding in the limousine with Eddie Henderson and my son to go to the concert. My son was just beaming. We're riding in the limousine with Eddie Henderson. And my son is telling the story to my wife on the phone after we finally get back. And I could hear, you know, my wife's side of the conversation without hearing her. You know, she's saying, "No way, that didn't happen. That didn't happen." And my son says, "Really? You wouldn't believe it. The guy walked up to us. He had us go in his limousine. We got to go to the concert for free." It was just an amazing day that I will never forget.
That is class. That is class. Now, you had another miracle where you were having a very difficult time paying your rent, weren't you?
Right, right. We literally were in a position where we were going to, you know, be homeless. I know that sounds crazy to people, but that was the point that I was in. You know, here I go, multimillionaire, to possibly being homeless. And one of our relatives had found out about this. And, you know, we did not know this person's, you know, financial wherewithal, that they had the ability to do this. And we certainly didn't want to ask them to do this. And they stepped forward and said, "I know what you're going through. I know it wasn't your fault. You're a victim of an embezzlement scheme. And I want to pay your rent for 1 year." and they paid our rent for 1 year. Literally the first of every month for that year, they called us up and said, the rent is due. I'm getting ready to send the check. And they would send us the check for a full year. And we never asked them to do that. They just came forward and did that.
My gosh.
It just an amazing thing. And again, God working through people. It's not always a bag of money that shows up on your doorstep. Sometimes it's a person. And these people are angels that do this to help out other people in circumstances like I was in.
So you lose your house to foreclosure, but the next day you move into a bigger house.
Yes, this was an amazing one. So as I related earlier, my daughter's asking me, Dad, are we going to lose the house? And we did lose the house. And you know how it is when you have a foreclosure. Back at this time, it only took about a year to lose your house to foreclosure. I know now people are in foreclosure for 2, 3, 4 years. But as the months are clicking away and you know that you're going to be kicked out of the house, you have those sleepless nights wondering what's going to happen. Where are we going to go? And I found an ad in the newspaper and met a lady who owned a home and was able to negotiate with her not only the ability to rent this house, but also have an option to buy this house, which I eventually was able to buy it. And here we were packing up our stuff to move out of the foreclosed house into the new house. Now, my nightmare, George, for months was my poor kids and what are they going to think when we lose our house and they have to lose their bedrooms? You know, they've got all their stuff hanging up and they love their home. And we had a little swimming pool and we just had a neat home on a golf course.
Yeah.
And they were going to lose all that. So here we are the next day moving into the new house. And literally within an hour, my kids were so excited. They were playing a Monopoly game to decide who would get what bedroom. In this house, they all got their own separate bedrooms. It was so big. In the other house, the two girls had to share a room. In this house, they got their own bedrooms. My son had a Nerf basketball hoop set up, and he was taking 10-foot jump shots across the kitchen. And when I walked in there and I saw my family, life is going on. They love the new house. And they said, Dad, we love this house. We're so glad that we got this house. And I was just stunned at that moment. I thought to myself, here I was dreading for months, losing the house, not having anywhere to go. And now I could stand there as a father and see my kids just loving this new house that God had provided to us. I mean, you go from, you lose your house, and the next day you move into a bigger house.
It doesn't happen.
Now, if that's not God, I don't know what it is.
And is this the house that you don't have a mortgage on?
No, we have subsequently even moved up from there. And we're now living in Palm Coast, Florida, near the beach. And we were able to pay cash for this house that we live in today.
How did you do that, if I can ask?
Well, we had an unexpected inheritance that came in. Now, when I tell people these stories, I almost feel guilty because I know people are listening tonight and they're going, yeah, we had a relative who we did not, we knew that there might be an inheritance someday, but we had no idea the amount of this amount. It would be this significant of an amount. And it put us in a position to be able to pay cash for a home. And, man, I'll tell you what, you go to a closing to buy a house and there's no mortgage and you're just paying cash for it after everything that I've been through, you talk about a victory lap around the block.
Holy
that moment. And that was just another miracle that God had provided.
Now, you, of course, did have a situation where you had a car repossessed, right? But you got lucky there, too.
Right. My car was repossessed. In fact, I knew they were coming to get it, so I called the Cadillac dealer and I said, I know you're coming to get my Cadillac. I'd rather save myself from the humiliation. Can I bring it to the dealer? And they said, sure, bring it down. And the guy was very nice to me. He said, look, we all go through good times and bad times. I know you'll be back again as a future customer. And he was a real gentleman in taking the keys back to my beautiful Cadillac. And I got back after losing the car and got a phone call from a relative that said, hey, I've got an extra car here that I don't ever drive, just sits in the driveway. I'd like to let you have it for as long as you need it, a year or two, or whatever you want to do. And they gave me the keys to the car, and I was able to drive this car around for over a year, no car payment, no obligation. Somebody just out of the blue, I didn't ask for this. They just stepped forward, and I knew it was God working through them to give me a car to use. We also found a car for my wife. Her car was repossessed. We went in the newspaper, found a car for just over $1,000 that we were able to buy. And the car was such a wonderful little car. My wife regretted later when we sold it to get her a newer model. She said, "Well, I'm going to miss that car because, you know, it was a car we paid cash for. It was an older car.
And you remember those days.
Reliable car. Yeah, yes, sir.
Those were important days. You remember them. And, you know, I'm sure there's a lot of luck involved in your life, James, but you've got a higher power. You've got some angels watching you.
Well, I don't think it's exclusive to me, George. You know, I appreciate you saying that, but I don't think I'm any more loved by God than anybody else. I think that I might have learned because of what I went through to turn to a higher power. And I think there's so many people struggling today, and they don't realize that there's a hand reaching down to pull them out of the water before they drowned. And they just have to look up to grab that hand. And I did that when I reached my moment of despair.
Funny you say that, because several years ago I had a call on Open Lines about someone who was literally telling me a story of how he was drowning in the ocean. The currents had kind of like brought him out, and he was too far offshore, and he was going down. And a hand breaks through the water and pulls him up. And as he's gasping, he turns to thank the person. He's about 100 feet off the beach. There's nobody there. Nobody there.
I believe it. And that's metaphorical to what happened to me. Absolutely.
We'll talk about some more. I've got to get into this television network letter that you sent maybe next hour, and we'll take some calls. But how do we get your books, like How to Pray for a Financial Miracle? I know you were on with me a year ago.
Yeah,
how do you get it?
Right. How to Pray for a Financial Miracle is available at Amazon.com, Barnes & Noble. It's available at Amazon as both a paperback book as well as a Kindle book, and it also has a prayer journal in the back. So the idea with this book, George, is you actually take this with you to your prayer sessions, whether it's to a mountain that you go to or a beach or wherever you find your peace and serenity, you bring the book with you. I've got the prayer outlined in there, and then I've got a whole section in the back that you use as a prayer journal to actually follow through on this prayer system. And it's not that my system's magic. It really isn't. It's not that. It's that I think that my system is all about listening to God, and that might be what makes my book unique, my approach different. It's not about having a magic prayer. It's about closing your mouth and listening to God, and that's something we just don't do enough.
Let's talk a little bit more next hour, plus we'll take some phone calls. Share your stories of miracles next.